Good morning, folks. It's time for Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show about the crucial political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Join us for a stimulating, thought-provoking discussion. You'll get the facts as we focus on the challenges facing everyone. Good morning, folks. Steve Williamson here. Welcome to Democratic Perspective on April 1st, April Fool's Day, Mike.
April 1st, but we're really here.
We really are here, and we're really not going to fool you. We're trying to do the exact
the Republicans fool you. Democratic Perspective tells you the truth. This is how it goes for 8 years now.
All right. Well, absolute truth, Mike.
Let's not go that far.
Even Klaus doesn't believe absolute truth.
I see. Relative truth.
All right. We have a professor.
Topic of another show.
Yeah. We have Professor Sheila Nair here today, and she's an expert on Southeast Asia, human rights, and women's rights, I guess, around the world. And you're a professor up at NAU and an expert. What we wanted to talk about, just to give my point of view, is that you have these horrendous events like the Vietnam War, the Cambodian genocide, and what happened in Laos. I mean, the bombs, I had a friend who was in Laos. They're still recovering buried bombs. They're still looking for the bombs that were dropped, the landmines. So we want to talk about, once the war is over and the press, all of us sort of go somewhere else where it seems more immediate. And we do a little bit of pretend backing up and checking on what happened, but we basically just move on. But maybe a society that's absorbed that extraordinary trauma, maybe they can't move on, you know. Maybe there's something else. And Professor Nair's been investigating and visiting museums in Vietnam, right, and Cambodia, and she's been trying to see how they understand what happened and the impact on the society now. How do they remember it?
Thank you. So my research essentially started on this particular topic sometime in 2012, when I first made a trip to Phnom Penh to visit the Tuol Sleng Museum there. And that visit inspired in me a wish or a desire to understand better how people were remembering what had happened under the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia between 1975 and 1979. About an estimated 1.7 million people died in that country, in some instances directly as a result of orders from the regime to execute individuals. And a large number died due to being forced into the countryside and subjected to starvation and hard labor. So the
kind of like our Native Americans. Go ahead.
Yeah. So the Tuol Sleng Museum in Phnom Penh is a special site because it housed large numbers of detainees who were then sent on to be executed in the killing fields.
So it's a former site where these people were held before they were murdered.
Right. So it was a detention prison center. Mm. There is an estimated, by some estimates, about 20,000 people passed through Tuol Sleng. It was also known as S21 by the Khmer Rouge. And it was a former secondary school. So anyway, coming back to my visit, when I went to Phnom Penh that summer of 2012 and visited the museum for the first time, it had been open for quite some time. But anyway, that was my first visit. It made me think that there were several things going on in terms of remembrance of the genocide. And so one of the things that I was especially curious about was the framing of the issue in this particular site. What kinds of first of all, what kinds of narratives were being threaded through this museum in terms of, you know, representation of the genocide, representation of violence. And also, for me, importantly, why was this such a popular tourist site? Yeah.
And it was the depth of the trauma was that it was Cambodians killing Cambodian. So that makes it different than remembering a war where somebody attacked you.
That's
or
right.
You attacked somebody else. This is more than a million people killed by Cambodians.
Yes, by a Cambodian government, by a Cambodian regime.
To me, this is very reminiscent of growing up in post-war Berlin, mm-hmm. and the things that happened there.
Mm-hmm. It's just the numbers are staggering.
Yes, yes.
Particularly the Cambodian population is not huge. I mean, we have 320 million plus people here.
So by some estimates, 25% of the population
25%
died during this period.
Thanks to the Nazis, we know how difficult that is.
To kill that many people.
Yes. So this particular site is just one of many memorial sites in Cambodia. There are 150 or more scattered around that have some substantial presence in the country, regional, local, community memorials. But there are also smaller remembrances. So if you travel through Cambodia, you're going to come across a village somewhere that has a small, stupa or site that commemorates
sure,
the dead.
Sure, the machine gun 30 or 40.
Yeah. So this clearly is a horrible thing that happened in Cambodian history. The causes and, one could say some of the factors that led up to it are complex, and it's going to be very difficult for me to get into those specific things in great depth today.
But how do Cambodians see what happened now? Because, it was not only traumatic, it was... people used to say the Cambodians are the nicest people in the world. So I heard somebody say way back. And
apparently the Germans were too.
Yeah, the most educated and the most refined. And yet you have this mass slaughter there. Mm-hmm. So if you're Cambodian, it kind of discredits you in a way that as a Cambodian this happened in your country. In the sense of... your own people did something very terrible to other of your own people. And how do you deal with that as a particular kind of experience? My question really is, how are they trying to deal with this?
Well, that's a tough question for me to answer because I wasn't doing research that involved talking to ordinary Cambodians. And there are special requirements, if you do that sort of research in terms of getting research clearance. And in any case, I wasn't interested in interviewing ordinary Cambodians about their reactions so much as I was interested in understanding the way that narrative is being constructed in a particular site, if that makes any sense. So there are ways in which governments create a particular history around mass violence. So in the case...
What the United States does every day.
Right. So, for example, there were clearly... there was clearly an objective in the creation of S21 as the Stolslang Museum of Genocide, which presents a particular understanding of the history and what led up to... this mass, to this genocide and mass slaughter, mass violence. So one of the things, let me just describe a little bit what happens, and I'm sure some of your listeners may have been to this museum and know what I'm talking about. But it's also something that anyone can go on the, internet and have, sort of a sense of what this museum is about because, there's a website that captures very nicely the layout of the museum, what it's about, the history, etc., and also has some documentary evidence.
It's true, and it happened.
Yes. So back to the question you were asking about what do ordinary Cambodians feel? I wanted to quickly respond that.
I think it's important to see how the government is lensing it and what it is telling it, what are the official. Because what we see is a lot of institutional dominance of memory and remembrance.
Mm-hmm. So ordinary Cambodians actually have been telling their stories. And these stories have been collected by the Documentation Center for Cambodia, or DCCAM. And actually, this is something that is a huge repository of information. It's an archive that, is being staffed by ordinary Cambodians who are some of whom are university students who are interning there, but a lot of them obviously are people who've worked there for a very long time who are experts in collecting this sort of information. And if you're looking for documentary evidence of, Cambodians' experiences with the genocide, survivor accounts, there's a lot of material that can be accessed through the archives. So back to the museum and the narrative that's being constructed. So one of the things that happens when you come to Tuol Sleng as a visitor is that you pay a small nominal, museum fee. It's I can't remember exactly how much it is right now, but it's a very small amount. And you enter the museum grounds, and there are, I think, 4 or 5 buildings that make up the museum. And one of the things that is most striking as you enter are the images. So, for example, you have these portraits of the people who passed through, photographs, I should say, of people who passed through Tuol Sleng, who were sent off to other centers or who were killed and tortured and killed. And so you have these very stark black and white photographs that are displayed. And actually, if you go to the Tuol Sleng Museum website, you'll be able to see these images. And there were exhibitions of these images that actually traveled. I think there was one in New York City, several years ago. But in any case, these images just sort of strike you in such a powerful way, because suddenly the genocide is now very, very, it's not personal so much as it has such an impact by the fact that you're viewing these faces, you're seeing these faces of people who were tortured and executed.
These life-size black and whites as you walk.
Well, they are
larger than life.
I'm not sure about the exact size, but they're probably 8 by 11 or thereabouts. And they are, usually headshots or chest up. And then there are photographs of children and mothers holding infants. So it has a huge impact on the visitor as they walk in.
Right. And is it I visited in Sevilla the Inquisition Museum in Sevilla, and they had the pictures of the people and the stories of the people who were murdered during the Inquisition.
Right. The Holocaust Museum.
Yeah, it was very disturbing, Sheila. Uh-huh. I mean, on a personal level, seeing the little cells, these people were held for years after after years, the torture chambers and stuff. Mm-hmm. So was it disturbing? I mean, you're a professor and an academic, but was it disturbing on a personal level?
Oh, yes. It very much was very disturbing on a personal level. And my first reaction was, I knew what to expect, but nevertheless, seeing these images and walking around the exhibit made me, it left me upset.
What is the government then telling people about why this happened? Who are the good guys and bad guys? Because we always seem to divide history into good guys and bad guys. What is the government telling people? And how, don't know, but how are they reacting to the official narrative or official narratives?
Yeah.
So let me follow up on the question, too. Are all of these memorials government-sponsored?
Yes, more or less, yes. Most of not some of the smaller ones, but they do get government funding, right? So one of the things that I think, going back to the issue of what is the government, what is the story?
What's the story? What are they telling people?
Well, clearly, on one hand, you could say the central narrative is that the Khmer Rouge did these horrible things, and that this government is trying to expunge that, you know, well, not expunge the history necessarily, but trying to address that history and providing a way for Cambodians to remember the past and to never forget that this happened. And I think this is actually, of course, critics have charged that the government has used Tol Sleng as a way to further shore up its standing and its position vis-a-vis the citizenry, the populace. But again, when it...
Wait, mm-hmm. It can happen again? Or okay.
Right. So the threat is if you know, the current government is not supported, if there are protests, there are challenges.
You thought this was bad. Wait till you see what we do.
Or look at how horrible it was and look at how great and stable we are today.
That's a little better than what I was thinking.
Yeah, they're looking for legitimacy.
Yes,
but
yes.
Why did the, what did they say that the Khmer Rouge, why, what was their motivation? Are they addressing that? In other words, why did you have the Khmer Rouge coming and killing all these people? What's the reason for it? Did they say it's ideology, or do they just,
right,
these are just bad, evil guys, or what?
Well, all of the above. But, I think one of the things that one has to understand is the current government actually has former members of the Khmer Rouge in their ranks. So what happened actually is it's very interesting that in Tol Sleng, when it was S21, the people who were initially brought to the prison tended to be, you know, from a wide range of society. But a lot of them happened to be people who were associated with the former regime, and also intellectuals, academics, writers, anyone who was considered part of the intelligentsia, and on and on. So that there were a lot of educated people who were initially brought to the prison and summarily, you know, executed because of either their political leanings prior to the coup, that the Khmer Rouge, that brought the Khmer Rouge to power, or who were identified with a kind of lifestyle or associated with a level of education that the Khmer Rouge deemed unacceptable. And you have to remember that the Khmer Rouge basically evacuated the cities and moved people to the countryside.
I remember seeing that all these people were marched out of the capital.
And
they were all urban people rather than peasants.
Townspeople.
And how are they going to survive? I mean, I think many of us looked at that and thought, oh, my God.
Right.
I don't know. Even in Cambodia, they're going to starve.
And many of them just left with whatever they could take with them and were marched to the countryside and put to hard labor and were made to do work that they had never done, ever done. And then there was food deprivation. You know, we're talking about very harsh labor conditions, even for the ordinary, you know, peasant who had been used to working on the land. But in any case, so this mass exodus that happened was rationalized by the Khmer Rouge as needing to cleanse Cambodia of its past history and moving the country to what some, I mean, at least historians have called the year zero in Cambodia, like basically getting it back to, you know, the basics. And this is a very warped ideology in a lot of ways.
So in some ways, the Khmer Rouge, who are communists and sort of want to move forward, or actually want to move back. They actually want to return to a simpler Cambodia without all the intellectuals and artists.
Right. But one has also got to keep in mind that this particular communist ideology that they professed wasn't necessarily consistent with what, you know, communist ideology might have been understood in a more conventional sense. So this was a very different type of and very specific kind of ideology that was specific to the Khmer Rouge.
It's a very extreme take on communism.
Yes, and a
very,
some would say erroneous take on what, you know, communist ideology was at the time. So back to the memorial site. So one of my interests in this research that I subsequently did after the visit to Tuol Sleng was to think about mass violence in Southeast Asia, because you started with, you know, there have been all of these horrible things that have happened in the region. But I just want to also say that not just in the region, obviously, but but being that Southeast Asia is you know, not a, I mean, it's obviously very diverse.
There's even been the typhoons and thousands and thousands of people killed with natural disasters.
Exactly.
In the area.
I mean, in Indonesia and you know, Myanmar and Thailand, there have been many of these horrible natural disasters recently. I wanted to say, switching over to, so one of my interests was also kind of was comparing these kinds of sites at least in two or three different countries. So I chose to focus on the Tuol Sleng Museum and the killing fields, Chengak in Cambodia. But I was also interested in, for example, the War Remnants Museum in Vietnam, in Ho Chi Minh City, and as well as in Indonesia, although I did not end up focusing on Indonesia per se, the events that happened in 1965 that led to, you know, huge
more than a million people were killed.
Yeah, and between half a million
hunted
to
down.
Right.
Well, maybe I'm wrong on the stats, but
yeah, I mean, I think estimates vary because it's so hard to get you know, sometimes accurate estimates, because a lot of it is reliant on government reporting on the data. So I think in the case of Indonesia, we're looking at between half a million to a million.
Just to go back to Vietnam for a second, you know, I was. We have the war. We lose 55,000 plus Americans. We have all these wounded.
Right.
We have a million Vietnamese dead.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're sitting around wearing underwear made in Vietnam, or our umbrella comes from Vietnam.
Right,
it just
right.
seems so utterly, completely pointless. But the other thing is the people I know who've gone to Vietnam, the mm-hmm. Americans who've gone to Vietnam, find a very friendly people.
Mm-hmm.
How can the Vietnamese be so friendly to Americans after this brutal mass slaughter of a war that's fairly recent anyway?
It's really astonishing. You're right.
Yeah. Why? How can they be so nice to Americans? I haven't run into anyone who wasn't treated well in Vietnam. You know, how are they looking at the war that they're good with doing this? Because we would be madder than hell. You know, I don't
That's
really
not
speak
true.
To.
Not a warrior. This is the way warriors behave. Go ahead, though. You have something to say.
Oh, I think this is fascinating, the question, because I think people do survive trauma. They survive war. They survive mass violence. And I think part of the lots of studies have been done about this. But I think what we're looking at specifically in the case of Vietnam is that a younger generation has moved on. And what we're seeing is a memory of that war is obviously, I mean,
it's called the American War in Vietnam.
In Vietnam, exactly. I was just going to say
it's called the Vietnam War.
Yes, thank you for that, because it is in fact called the American War in Vietnam by the Vietnamese, and there was actually a book by that title too by an anthropologist out in California who's written a brilliant book on the American War in Vietnam, and it's.
Frances, I'm mumbling her last name because I don't remember.
Uh-huh.
She wrote a wonderful book called Fire on the Lake.
Oh, yes.
And to the Vietnamese,
yes.
the American Vietnam War was like a fire in the lake. It was just, and so it was easy to, since mm-hmm. it was such an anomaly,
mm-hmm.
that it was easy to, it existed for a time and now it's gone.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm going to be quiet again and let you talk.
Right.
About your, I want to thank you for taking your time that you painted a wonderful picture of Cambodia. You know, we're on radio, so I'm told, and that those verbal pictures are kind of important. Mm-hmm. And to have this picture painted for us of this horrible time, and just to back up, we're doing democratic perspective. We're talking about the research into the genocide in Cambodia and some other places, as opposed to the anecdotal, which is usually interesting and fires people up, but has absolutely nothing to do with necessarily the truth, the anecdotal evidence of interviewing people. You kind of left that part out. Mm-hmm. While we find that fascinating, myself as a researcher agrees with what you're doing, that what you're finding is much more truth by sticking microphones in people's faces and finding out what happened to them.
Right. Well, I think there's merits to the different types of research tools one uses. But in terms of the interviews themselves, I mean, in terms, you know, like talking to survivors about their trauma, it's an awfully difficult thing to do. And I think that my purpose in doing this research was not so much to extract from survivors their trauma stories, but rather to think about how trauma gets narrated in these kinds of spaces.
So how is it being narrated?
I mean, right.
What is the Vietnamese government telling Vietnamese?
So I think
visitors like you.
So if you go to Ho Chi Minh City and you visit this museum, the War Remnants Museum, it's an extremely powerful narrative that runs through this space or the spaces of this museum. And I thought when I first visited the museum several years ago that one of the things that would be wonderful is to bring American students to on a study abroad, you know, to Southeast Asia, but make sure that they visited this museum because it provides an alternative story. And obviously an alternative history to what is presented in the United States to students.
How does it differ?
So it differs because it presents the Vietnamese understanding of this war. And it presents it in a very different way than I think that war is understood in this country, mainly through the lens or through the filter of the loss of American lives and the loss of American, the expenditure of American resources and all of the things, you know, that circulate around it. Now, I have not watched the Ken Burns documentary, the recent, you know, multiple-part series, so I'm not sure how that is being captured, how the Vietnamese understanding of the war is being captured in that documentary. But a lot of films that I have watched on the Vietnam War in this country and materials, at least in the public, I mean, that are more publicly accessible or not scholarly, have tended to be a little more, you know, obviously skewed towards the American perspective. So this is the Vietnam.
Well, isn't the American perspective that this war was really a mistake, and property was destroyed, and lives were lost on both sides, and it shouldn't have happened in the first place? And I was wondering, does the Vietnamese view of that differ, and in what ways does it differ?
Yes, the question I'd like to reinforce Klaus's question, which is, why do they think that we basically invaded their country and started this war? What did they think was our motivation? Who do they think we are that we did this?
Well, I think going back to the War Remnants Museum, in terms of how it represents the history of this war, what it does is it traces, I mean, I think it puts front and center the Vietnamese struggle against European imperialism. Mm-hmm. So first the French and then the Americans. So this is a war of national liberation, a revolutionary war. It is resistance. It is a resistance against oppression, against foreign domination, and so on. And what it chronicles, apart from you know, the struggles against the French, is the heroism and the Americans, is the heroism displayed by the Vietnamese as they are being, you know, subjected to this kind of relentless and you know, in this, in the depictions in the museum, relentless bombardment and so forth. And ultimately, the story of victory, which is, you know, prevailing against the might of two European, one European and one American, power.
Pseudo-European.
So European and American imperialism is just, yeah. So, And what it provides is documentary, a very, very in-depth documentary narrative of that's represented in photographs and captured in images. And it has all of the atrocities, you know, depicts many of the atrocities that were committed, some of the major things like what happened at My Lai and other mass atrocities that took place during the war, the killings of civilians, the cages that were used to, you know, hold prisoners, and the torture of Vietnamese soldiers and civilians. So the construction, and then of course, you know, as you enter the museum, you see some of the captured material from the war. So that's also on full display. And I think all of it evokes a sense of this small country prevailing, or fighting force prevailing against, you know, this.
Superpowers.
Yes, these superpowers. At least a superpower at the time of, you know, the war in, American war in Vietnam. And another thing that is also very interesting in this museum is the fact that the Vietnamese saw the support of large numbers of people around, and governments around the world as a testimony of the righteousness of their cause and their struggle. So there's that too. So there's a whole section where there are pictures taken from, you know, rallies being held all over Europe in support of their struggle against the Americans and the war against and the fight against the Americans. And then there is a whole new relation to the rest of the exhibits how new it is. I can't recall exactly right this moment, but there is a section that's devoted to the effects of Agent Orange. And the, you know, so when we think about the intergenerational impacts, this is one of the ways that the war is experienced in the bodies of Vietnamese today.
To be clear, we not only poisoned our own, we poisoned thousands and thousands of Vietnamese.
Right.
But
right.
What you're saying really doesn't differ all that much from what our perception of the Vietnam War is now, does it?
Well, I would say that you don't have these kinds of stock representations of what the Americans did in Vietnam.
Yeah, you don't, in the Deer Hunter, you don't get that. We had cages also in the, in
well,
coming
that torture
home
was
with Jane Fonda. You get the American narrative, this poor guy in the wheelchair, I mean, Full Metal Jacket. You don't get the Vietnamese narrative.
A friend was in Laos, and there are still people hobbling around. So many people have been, had their legs and feet blown off by landmines. I mean, he said you go around and there's all these crippled, wounded people. They're very nice, but they don't have a leg, or they've lost an arm. Mm-hmm. And the remnants of the war, the results of the war are still with us physically. As well as intellectually and emotionally.
I mean, it's astonishing, or maybe not astonishing, how much all of this parallels my experience of growing up after the after World War II, crippled people in the street, a tremendous sense of guilt as to what we did, and this tremendous trauma, which I'm certainly still subject to. I still have nightmares about movies about concentration camps that they showed us when we were 14.
I have to
say, the current generation is the first generation. So my nieces and nephews who are in their 30s feel much more removed from it, but my generation was profoundly impacted by it.
Well, I'm sure, absent the guilt, I have to say, Klaus, the guilt, the Vietnamese are liberators.
The Vietnamese were victims, right?
Yes, and so there is no guilt except for the human guilt, perhaps.
This is more going back to the Khmer Rouge.
Yeah, the United States entered the war in Vietnam with no idea who the Vietnamese were, And I remember those who are, others began opposing the war. Once we started reading about Vietnamese, the whole history of resistance to foreign invasion, all the nonsense about the Chinese controlling them, you know, I read all that stuff with a sinking heart because I knew we were in for it. And in those days, there was almost no information. We went in there with no information about the Vietnamese. And that's why I think it's important for all different kinds of scholarship to take place so that we understand it from statistical to interviews.
Right. I also think going back to the question about, you know, you asked when we started this segment on the Vietnam experience, you asked why are people so nice and friendly to Americans?
It seems paradoxical.
Yes.
Well, I think that it's been quite a while now since the war ended, and societies and governments do try to, despite, you know, of course they want to make sure that their people understand the history, and so do visitors. Nevertheless, I think there is definitely a normal, perhaps ordinary human impulse to move on and to do the kinds of things, nation building and so forth, that comes along, you know, after such a devastating experience. I mean, you have to move on in this situation, where if you were just to dwell on what had happened, it would be very difficult to, you know, sort of construct a new path forward. But that doesn't mean you forget the history, of course. Right. I mean, the history is terribly important to that new path forward, or the path forward to the future. So without neglecting the history, and there's a lot of this history that is not only in the War Remnants Museum but it's evident, it's true throughout Vietnam's landscape. I mean, you have now you have many of these places being tourist sites. So the tunnels, the underground tunnels, right, have become, you know, tourist sites, and they are clearly there's an even more interesting sort of, you know, diorama there of what took place in the context of the war, in terms of, you know, how the North Vietnamese came up with these traps to, you know, capture people and that sort of thing. And anyway, so I think that the past obviously lives on in the present, but in terms of how the Vietnamese themselves I mean, if you were a visitor there and you were thinking, oh my, everyone is really friendly here, what does that, you know, what does that mean? I think in general, I think it would be fair to say that the Vietnamese economy today is so tourist driven. A good part of it is so open and definitely foreign investment and tourist dollars are really important, that I don't think that the Vietnamese see this as necessarily a contradiction. You know, that they've had this,
best,
yeah.
They're doing what's best for the country now.
Yeah.
Just as they were doing what's best for the society in 1968.
Right.
We're going to repel, we're going to kill as many as possible in as horrible a way as possible to get these people to leave. We're going to be nice to these people to get them to spend as much money as possible, because that's what we need now. It's really not more complicated.
I'm not sure I would put it quite that way, but
maybe I'm a little cynical. I don't know.
Right.
This could be.
I do think that there is a genuine openness to the world in Vietnam, and there are, you know, people who are, I mean, from south to north, east to west in Vietnam, I mean, there are variations.
So this
I mean,
is who they really were, and we couldn't exterminate it. We couldn't get it out of them. We couldn't get their natural friendliness.
Well, I think when you're at war, you know, it's a very different situation. I'm not sure you can compare. I mean, people if they feel like they're under siege, it's going to be very hard for them to
But I think we are. I think people expect, Stephen expects that hatred to carry on. And we're saying it's disappeared.
Right. Well, I'm not sure it's disappeared. I'm not sure that people, I mean, again, you know, you're looking at a younger generation who didn't live through
it. It's not expressed.
Right?
Well, let's give you a couple of examples. For example, I have a Chinese friend. He bought a Japanese car. His uncle yelled and screamed at him, "Why are you buying a Jap car?" That's the term he used. don't you remember, you know, what the Japanese did to us in China? And you have a lot of people having, I guess, proactive responses to what's happened in the past. They, you know, and I will say, for example, that, that there's a lot of prejudice that we don't talk about because of past wars. But I wanted to ask, you know, to talk to her. You're an academic and you're doing very detailed research, but what are your takeaways that you would tell ordinary Americans about what your research and what your experience is in Southeast Asia? In other words, just that. What are your major takeaways from all of this? Because you've done so much work there.
Yeah, I think I very much resist and have concerns about with understandings of people as occupying certain cultural, you know, personalities, whole people. So whether it's the sense that, oh, the Vietnamese are nice or the Cambodians are so friendly and so on. People are people. And the thing is that if you are, obviously there are cultural differences across countries, but one of the things that my research, tries to address is not so much teasing out these cultural sensibilities, but I'm more interested in the politics of, you know, how these things get, understood. So, for example, when I'm looking at narratives in museums, I'm approaching it as a, you know, someone who's interested in the political narrative, right? As well as the underlying cultural, historical, social, factors that contribute to a construction of a particular narrative. But there is a political process whereby these things come to be that I'm interested in sort of unraveling and untying. And I think that the comment that was made about, you know, why do they, you know, were they full of hate back then and not now? Well, I'm not sure that that's entirely, I wouldn't think of it in those terms because going back to that point, I think that there are clearly things that come out during a war that you can't really see a people as representative of what they were as they were fighting a war or their dispositions in quite that way. Again, there are today all kinds of other concerns that Cambodians and Vietnamese and Indonesians have, you know, surviving, for example. And that there are very serious economic and other political issues that they face, that they're dealing with.
Too. For non-scholars, are there books or articles they could follow up on or a website? You mentioned the website that you could really, I guess, almost walk through this museum in Cambodia. If people are interested in this and they're, you know, they don't have a giant research library, what should they do?
Yeah, so I think one of the first things that they just wanted to understand what these spaces are like, just go to Google, you know, Tuol Sleng or the Genocide Museum in Phnom Penh. And
spell it.
T-U-O-L, one word, S-L-E-N-G, second word. Okay. And then if they want to see what the War Remnants Museum is like, do the same. And they can just go through the website. And then there are resources as well that are referenced there.
Thank you. These are real complicated issues, as we've outlined in the last 45 minutes in trying to get these things out. And you did paint a wonderful picture. We do want to I'm going to key on your word narrative. We're one of the points of your speech this morning was to try to get the other side's narrative, the Cambodian narrative in this case, and Vietnamese and Myanmar. As opposed to what we hear here, the narrative of Donald Trump has been, and the Democrats have screwed up, and we've let them take over the narrative. And when it comes to exoneration, what the special counsel did was give us a path to charge with obstruction of justice or collusion. But so that narrative, the other narrative will continue at Democrats of the Red Rocks. The narrative will continue at the Yavapai Democrats in Cottonwood. Please check out our events on our webpage. Thank you.
been listening to Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show focusing on the political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and our nation at large. Catch us every Monday morning after the 8 a.m. news, right here on AM 780 KAZN. It's beautiful out there, folks. Have a great day.